From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, federal agents with SWAT team training are now working with Boston immigration officials. Mayor Marty Walsh is among those criticizing the move.
I quite don't understand if you're so concerned about immigration into the country and why you would take agents off the southern border and put them into selected cities around the United States of America.
Also today, the race for the Democratic nomination is on.
We're two states in with 55 states and territories to go. We still have 98% of our delegates for our nomination up for grabs.
Party official James Roosevelt breaks down the new rules on the Democrats' delegates. And the evolving power of the presidency.
I take executive action only when we have a serious problem.
Then I have an Article 2 where I have the right to do whatever I want as president.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Federal agents, some with SWAT team training, are now working with Boston immigration officials. It's a story that's been developing over the weekend, and our reporter, Shannon Dooling, has been following all of the action. She joins us now in Studio 3. Hey there, Shannon.
Hi, Callum.
So the Times broke a version of this story on Friday, and then you've been following it since then. Can you explain what exactly is going on? I mean, who are these new agents who are in our city? How many of them are here? What are they doing?
Yeah, there are still a lot of questions, and we'll start with that. But we know that they're already here in Boston, that we do have some of these SWAT team-trained border agents here in Boston. According to the New York Times, there are about 100 or so being deployed around the country into a number of different cities, but I've not yet been able to confirm how many are actually working here in Boston. And, I mean, the nature of their mission here and across the country is essentially to back up ICE's deportation officers who are in charge of bringing individuals into custody for immigration violations. The acting director of ICE, Matthew Albence, says that these specialists are being tapped to help make these arrests in the interior of the country to, quote, supplement enforcement activity in response to the resource challenges stemming from sanctuary city policies.
Huh. But the skill set you're describing, these sort of SWAT training, conjures like a scene from Breaking Bad or something,
yeah,
right? Like along
yeah.
the border. So why are they here in Boston?
Well, I mean, what I'm told is that as sanctuary city policies have sort of ramped up across the country, including here in Boston, the logic goes that it's harder for ICE officials to make arrests in places like courtrooms and police stations. And so what they're being faced with is going into communities and essentially knocking on more doors to try to make arrests than maybe what they were accustomed to doing before the Trump administration, during the Trump administration. And so basically, you know, it's part of a plan, a federal immigration plan, to deploy these specially trained border agents to cities across the country. So Boston, San Francisco, Houston. And of course, it is this broader effort by the Trump administration to crack down on sanctuary cities. We've heard this from him in the past, that we have a real sore spot in Trump's side, really, with sanctuary city policies. And it's where local law enforcement essentially purposefully limit their cooperation with ICE.
So what is ICE saying then about what the need is in these sanctuary cities? I mean, we have this
right.
Trust Act in Boston,
right.
for example. Are they pointing at that?
Right. Exactly. I mean, that would be our sanctuary city policy, essentially. So here in Boston, we Mayor Walsh just passed what he called a stronger Trust Act at the end of the year in 2019. It limits the amount of interaction and cooperation between Boston police and ICE. And so things like the only reason they should be communicating essentially are about individuals who are wanted for, as Walsh would say, serious crimes, violent felonies, organized gang behavior.
And it's worth noting this is not just a policy decision, right? I mean, the state's highest court here in Massachusetts has said that local law enforcement can't enforce these ICE detainers, as they're called, right? Can you explain that? I mean, what is a detainer and what are local police allowed or not allowed to do?
Right. So that's right. In 2017, the SJC exactly stated that there's no statutory authority here in Massachusetts for local law enforcement or court officers to honor these ICE detainers. An ICE detainer is a request. It's an administrative warrant, not a criminal warrant, from ICE asking local officials to hold someone in custody who otherwise is free to go. And so that might be because they've paid bail. It might be because charges have been dropped. It might be because they completed a sentence, a criminal sentence, and they're now free to leave.
So ICE would ask as like a courtesy, hey,
exactly.
Would you hold
Give
on
us
to
a
this
heads
person?
Up. Hold on to this person for up to 48 hours. We think they might have immigration violations.
And the court says police can't do that.
The court says the police and court officials, whether it's a judge or a bail magistrate, can't do that. And so you combine the sanctuary city policies in towns and cities across the state, and you combine that with the SJC's decision about ICE detainers. And ICE is saying, look, all of a sudden, we can't take someone into custody in the safety of a controlled setting like a court or a police station. And so we're having to make more arrests in the communities. We need some backup. These special agents and officers from Customs and Border Protection are here to help with more arrests.
I see. So what's the concern then? I mean, is there a public safety threat here? Mm-hmm. I mean, so ICE seems to be saying we don't get this assistance from local police anymore. We need more bodies on the ground. But so do we know who these SWAT-trained agents are targeting?
Right. We don't know specifically. It could be, according to ICE, yes, the answer is that there is an actual safety threat, a public safety threat in the community. And this is why we're having to up the ante, so to speak. We heard from ICE's acting director that sanctuary policies are allowing criminals to be released back into the streets. And, that makes things more unsafe when we're seeing, when there's, according to ICE, seeing more arrests being made of criminals in communities. It's interesting because also on Friday in a separate release, so we hear from the federal folks in D.C., the head of the acting head of ICE, the acting head of Customs and Border Protection. But on Friday, we also in a separate release heard from our own head of what's called enforcement and removal operations here in Boston, the Boston area of responsibility, which is actually all of New England. We heard from him. His name is Todd Lyons. And in a release, he said that, look, we're going to start highlighting these, quote, what the release refers to as immigration fugitives. And the reason why we're going to start broadcasting these people's information and photos in public press releases is because these are the types of examples of people who are being let free because of ICE detainers, because people aren't honoring ICE detainers. Law enforcement isn't honoring ICE detainers here in Massachusetts. And so in that laundry list of individuals, he names five people and lists things, sort of criminal charges. Now, it's very important to know, Cal, that these are charges in many cases, not convictions. Very different. And so some of the charges that these immigration fugitives are wanted on or have in their history are things like assault, rape, multiple driving under the influence charges. Again, not convictions. So these essentially could be the types of examples that ICE is saying, okay, we used to be able to pick this person up at the police station. Now they're not honoring these requests. That person who was charged with assault and battery is let back out into the community. Now we have to go face that person who has these charges, maybe not a conviction, but has been charged with this. We're going to get some backup from people who are accustomed to sort of using more authority and more tactical SWAT-like team entrances into places. Of course, immigrant advocates, I know we'll talk to one later on in the show, and community members worry that, non-convicted criminals, even charged criminals, might get caught up in these arrests. So there's a bit of there's a lot of confusion, and I think, a lot of questions still need to be answered.
Sure, and not everybody is convinced as ICE lays out its explanation, including the mayor. We mentioned at the top that Boston Mayor Marty Walsh isn't thrilled with this move. Here's what he had to say over the weekend.
I quite don't understand why you would take somebody from the southern border if you're so concerned about immigration into the country, take agents off the southern border and put them into selected cities around the United States of America. I don't quite understand that rationale at all.
We've also heard from Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey over the weekend. They both wrote to federal immigration officials saying that the agency should withdraw this plan. And one other voice chiming in as well was Congressman Joe Kennedy. He says that this type of move might actually decrease public safety.
Because people feel not as comfortable engaging with law enforcement if you are victims or are witnesses to a crime. It means scaring people forward as the census starts to get up and running and we need people to stand out and get counted.
So, Shannon Dooling, stick with me on this. I want to develop that idea about public safety a little bit more. But as we do, I want to bring in another voice. We're joined now by Ava Malona. She's the executive director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, also known as MIRA. Ava, hello. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for your time. Real quick, can we just get your reaction to what we know so far about the presence of these new agents in our city?
So first, let me say that, what Shannon just pointed out, there are so many unanswered questions about what's happening and the accuracy of this policy. One thing that it's very clear is that Massachusetts and our cities are following the law and the Constitution. The highest court in our state ruled in 2017 that, you know, people cannot be arbitrarily detained. Nothing prevents immigration enforcement, if they show with a judicial warrant, to arrest someone who is charged for crime. So in our view, this is extremely disturbing. I mean, terrorizing the communities, intimidating cities, scaring the immigrant families for political points, it's a very dangerous tactic. And we see this as part of a series of a political stunt that it's happening in many states and many cities.
Well, Ava, as you say, it could be dangerous. Can you just be precise about what exactly the fear is there? I mean, is it excessive force? What are you worried about?
First of all, given the inflammatory rhetoric about immigrants and refugees, people have been through trauma for the last couple of years, and this adds to the fears of people coming forward, A, contacting the police, B, appearing to courts or getting access to courts, and this is really also concerning about collateral damage for individuals who have no conviction, who have no trouble with the law. People who are mixed status household families or victims of domestic violence who are afraid to call 911. So the collateral damage is really very a dangerous tactic. A concern for us. So we see this as a very dangerous tactic, undermining the safety of our communities. We live here. We know that we are safe because of the work that has been done for building strong trust and strong relationship between the community police, between the community and the police. And such tactics really being politicized are really not making us safe and not protecting anyone.
If I'm hearing you right, Ava, that public safety concern is that perhaps if you intimidate immigrant communities in this way, they might be less likely to cooperate with law enforcement, and that might allow other crimes to go on.
Deeply underground, and this issue of enforcement has been extremely politicized, and this really impacts the safety of all of us. Massachusetts, about 69 or 70 municipalities across our state have come up with trust acts for the reason to make their communities safer. And coming up with such policies, it's deeply, deeply concerning. And we're working, MIRA is working closely with the New England AILA and other partners and members to make sure that we do have the accurate information for our community. Traditionally, we reached out to ICE and to CBP to make sure we have the accurate information, and we will do that again. But it's really troubling that, A, you know, the rumors and fears take the life of their own. So we want to make sure the community have the information that they need. There is accurate information being distributed, but the politicization of this issue is very, very troubling for all of us.
That's Ava Malona. She's the executive director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, also known as MIRA. Ava, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shannon, just as we pick up on Ava's thought there, you know, the counter, of course, from ICE officials to her public safety worry is that, you know, we're going to be going after dangerous criminals and trying to get them up off the streets. And if I'm hearing Ava properly, she and her group are concerned that it won't be confined to just those most dangerous criminals, that there will be spillover to sort of run-of-the-mill immigration enforcement. So in the moments we have left, I mean, is that what comes next now? Is just that monitoring from your perspective? Is this actually deployed?
Right. I mean, I think that that's clearly something we're going to be watching is how is it deployed? What are the ripple effects of this, both sort of real effects in terms of numbers of arrests and things like that, quantifiable effects, and also the sort of hidden effects. Do people start keeping their children home from school? Do people miss work because they're afraid to drive or leave their homes? So we'll be in touch with immigrant communities and with federal officials to see how this plan is working out here in Boston.
All right. Keep following Shannon Dooling's reporting for all of those follow-ups. Shannon, thank you so much for your time
today.
You're
welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, what's behind new Democratic delegate rules for 2020, and how will they impact the primary season? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're in the thick of the Democratic primary season, and while the popular vote in early states like Iowa and New Hampshire commands a lot of attention, the nomination really comes down to delegates. Those are the people who will vote at the Democratic National Convention this summer. A candidate needs a majority of them to carry the party's banner in November. And this year, the delegate rules are a bit different and more transparent. Last time around, many supporters of Bernie Sanders claimed the rules were unfair. Sanders himself suggested on MSNBC last year that he may have been cheated out of the nomination.
Some people say that if maybe that system was not rigged against me, I would have won the nomination and defeated Donald Trump. That's what some people say.
We're going to get into the new rules with James Roosevelt. He's an attorney and a Democratic Party official. He's the co-chair for the Rules Committee at the Democratic National Committee and will co-head the Credentials Committee at the DNC convention in Milwaukee in July. Hello there, James. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, Callum. Glad to be with you.
We're glad to have you. So probably one of the most prominent changes was to the role of superdelegates in the nominating process. Can you explain the rule changes real quick and what was behind them? I mean, was this all about satisfying those concerns from Sanders supporters?
Yes. So the superdelegates, or the actual term in the rules is automatic delegates, are people who hold party or elected official offices who don't have to run to become a convention delegate. And moreover, they don't have to pledge themselves to one of the candidates to become a convention delegate. So in the past, they went into the conventions not necessarily pledged to a delegate, or they could have chosen to pledge to a delegate. And what the Senator Sanders is complaining about there is that when the automatic delegates went into the convention and and even before the convention were allowed to announce who they were going to support at the convention, the press started counting those numbers, and that gave Secretary Clinton an apparent lead, even when she was not necessarily leading in the delegates chosen in the primaries and caucuses.
And the complaint of course, is that it can promote this air of invincibility or inevitability and perhaps affect actual voting in primaries as it goes along, right?
That's correct. Now, by the time we got to the convention, in fact, Secretary Clinton had more delegates that had been chosen in primaries and caucuses. But who knows how those were affected by what people had been reading or hearing in the media about, as you say, the inevitability of Secretary Clinton.
So these superdelegates, James, they do still exist. They haven't disappeared, but they have a different role this time around in 2020. So what will their function be at this summer's convention?
That's right. After a very extensive process where we had 80 hours of public hearing and had recommendations from a committee composed of both Clinton and Sanders supporters, our Rules and Bylaws Committee that I co-chair recommended to the full Democratic National Committee a number of changes in the rules. One of them was that the superdelegates will not be allowed to vote on the first ballot. They can do everything else. They can go to they can be on the floor of the convention. They can be involved in the platform and the rules and so on, but they can't vote on the first ballot. If it should go to a second or more ballot, then they get to vote. But what that means is that when the Associated Press and CNN and so on do their tallies how many delegates a candidate has going into the primaries in the various states, those superdelegates can't be counted because they may never get to vote if it's decided on the first ballot.
And in fact, in most recent conventions, they would not have had an opportunity to vote under this format because usually we know who the nominee is going in. I'm almost reluctant to ask this because, you know, journalists love the idea of a brokered convention or an open convention, as it's called. But it does seem like an actual possibility this time around. So how would that work? I mean, if no candidate has a majority on that first ballot and we get to a brokered convention where all the delegates are released of their obligations, what happens then, James?
So I do like the term open convention or contested convention better than brokered, because brokered conjures up the bosses of past years making a decision in the smoke-filled rooms. And not only do we not have smoke anymore, we don't have bosses cannot, or another rule we have now is that they cannot pledge the people in their delegation. Everyone gets their own vote. But I do think an open convention, I mean, Nate Silver is saying it's somewhere between a 35 and a 50% possibility that we will have an open convention.
Nate Silver, of course, being the well-known political prognosticator who runs 538.
Right. That is appropriate. It means that a candidate that that starts late might have a chance. It means that if there is really a diversity of views in the party as the primaries and caucuses go along, maybe a convention is just what it's set out to be, a body that makes a decision on who will be the best nominee to represent the party's point of view.
In a sense, then, an open convention would be rather caucus-like. And I want to ask you a little bit about the first caucus that we had in Iowa, because, you know, all these rules changes were, I think, designed to help the process feel more transparent, feel fairer, to instill more faith in the process. And after all that, it really got off to an inauspicious start in Iowa. I think everybody would agree on that. Do you think that that damaged the credibility of the nominating process?
I think it has had a damaging perception here at the outset, and I'm hoping that will be overcome as we move along. But it was done, again, with full open consultation and at the particularly the urging of the of Senator Sanders supporters to make it more transparent. So the big difference, there are two big differences in the Iowa process this year from in the past. They wanted the same basic process, where they assemble, they talk among themselves for an hour or so, then they go to different corners of the room to indicate who they're for. And if some candidate doesn't have enough people in their corner, they can move to another corner for the second count. But the differences were that, first of all, the reporting of the vote was much more transparent. Now, it's been always necessary that there is a first count, so you determine who meets the 15% threshold to get any delegates at all, and then a second count after they rearrange, or as they say, reallocate themselves. And those two numbers are what determine how many delegates that candidate gets in that county.
Which is how you can have sort of different results, right? We have the Sanders campaign pointing to what appears to be a popular vote win in Iowa, and yet Pete Buttigieg comes out with what appears right now to be a slight delegate lead. James, I do want to pick up on one thing you mentioned a moment ago while we still have time. You talked about somebody entering the race late, and of course Mike Bloomberg is the one who comes to mind there.
Although Deval Patrick could come to mind.
Well, that's true, but what Deval Patrick lacked, of course, was right. Mike Bloomberg's billions, and so I want to ask you about the role that money plays in the nominating process. A lot of Democrats aren't happy about the role that money can play in making a candidate come out of the field late and be relevant. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, for example, has complained about this. Here she is on MSNBC over the weekend.
I wasn't going to spend my time sucking up to the Michael Bloombergs of the world. I was going to do this grassroots.
So what do you think, James Roosevelt? I mean, is Mike Bloomberg buying the election? Is the DNC doing enough to limit the influence of money in the nominating process?
Well, I do think that first Senator Sanders, and then along with him at this time, Senator Warren, changed the playing field by building a campaign fund built on small donations. However, there has the limitations on what can be spent are subject to federal law, not to rules we make in the party. And Mayor Bloomberg is obviously willing to spend a lot of his money, although as a percentage of his total money, it's not probably that much. But a lot of his money,
he can afford
the same way Tom Steyer is, apparently to a greater effect than Tom Steyer is getting.
You know, one of the things I want to ask you about is just, you know, the role of folks like yourself, sort of veteran party officials on these rules and credentials committees. I mean, you've, I'm sure, heard complaints such as those in The New Republic, the popular progressive magazine, saying that, you know, folks like yourself or Barney Frank just sort of form a, you know, an insider's club. You represent the establishment of the party, and that that itself can erode faith in the fairness of the process for Sanders supporters and Warren supporters. I mean, what do you say to those concerns?
Well, the highest compliment I got in 2016, with all the recriminations that went on between the Sanders and Clinton campaigns and the DNC itself, of course, was that Jeff Weaver, who was Senator Sanders' campaign manager, and Larry Cohen, who was one of his chief strategists, came to me, said the one thing we found we could count on all the way along is that you and your co-chair were always fair to us. So that's our standard in the Rules and Bylaws Committee. That will be our standard in the Credentials Committee.
I do want to step back, James Roosevelt, while I have you on this President's Day, from talking about the immediacy of the 2020 race to just kind of a bigger picture. I mean, you are the grandson of President Franklin Roosevelt. How are you reflecting on his legacy today?
Well, it is kind of a great coincidence that we're having this conversation today. As someone pointed out in something I was reading earlier today, when I was growing up, we had both a Lincoln's birthday holiday and a Washington's birthday holiday. Then we combined them, and then someone decided to make it sweep in all presidents. And I do think honoring the office is a great thing. I'm not sure every single president is a person I would want to honor, but I am more than happy to have the opportunity to honor both my grandfather Franklin on the Democratic side and my great uncle Teddy on the Republican side.
You know, in recent years, I'm thinking back to the campaign of 4 years ago when the current president, before he was elected, Donald Trump, cited your grandfather's internment of Japanese Americans as a rationale for his Muslim travel ban. And we saw members of your family strongly condemn that. I mean, is that something you think about today, too? Sort of the mixed bag that goes with remembering the legacies of all presidents, including your grandfather.
Well, every president has a mixed bag of decisions that are made in moments of crisis, including, for example, Abraham Lincoln's suspension of the right of habeas corpus. And it's pretty clear now that President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, my grandfather, made a very serious mistake in ordering the internment of the Japanese. On the other hand, he was faced with an attorney general in California who said that the people of California could not be safe as long as that didn't happen. That Attorney General was Earl Warren, who was so popular because of it. In 1946, he received both the Democratic and Republican nominations for governor of California, was overwhelmingly elected, beat my father again in 1950, and then became an historic Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
It's quite the history lesson. James Roosevelt, thank you so much for spending some time with us on this President's Day to remember your grandfather and also to talk about 2020 with us. James Roosevelt is an attorney and Democratic Party official. He is the co-chair for the Rules Committee at the Democratic National Committee. Happy President's Day to you, sir.
Same to you, Callum.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's President's Day, and while that might mean some good discounts for you shoppers out there, I for one got an excellent bargain on a new washing machine this weekend, it's also a chance for us to take a look at the office of the presidency, how the founders envisioned it, and how its occupants have expanded the power of the position through the years. Here with me in Studio 3 to help us do just that is Stephen Knott. He's a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College, a presidential historian, and author of the new book, The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, The Decline into Demagoguery and the Prospects for Renewal. Steve, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Thomas Whalen. He's a political historian and professor of social sciences at Boston University. Tom, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this President's Day as well. Is the presidency too powerful in your view? Or does the president need to be strong in order to get anything done these days? Give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Steve, let me start with you, because I want to just establish from the get-go how you see the founders' vision for the presidency. Before we explain how we've descended into demagoguery and lost our soul, as you put it, what was the baseline that we should have started from?
Well, the baseline was one that the founders conceived of the president as a unifying figure, as at least in part, a head of state. And most of the founders would have rejected the sort of demagoguery that's become part and parcel of modern politics. And by modern, I mean for the last 110 or 20 years. So there was a more constrained, more restrained view of the office. The president was seen as a unifying figure. He was not, unfortunately, it's been all he was not expected to go out, beat the partisan bushes, stir the pot. He was expected to be restrained. He was expected in some ways to defer to Congress on legislative matters. I'm not necessarily arguing that we need to go back to all of that, but I do think we're in a bad spot at the moment. We've sort of torn away any of the constitutional and sort of semi-constitutional traditions that were built up around the presidency. And I think we are very much in the midst of a demagogic presidency as we sit here today.
Well, you know, oddly enough, the framework that you're describing is largely outlined, at least as you write about it, by a man who never was president, Alexander Hamilton. He also, though, wanted a very strong president in other regards. That seems like a very fine line. So how did he propose walking that line?
Sure. No, it's a terrific question. Hamilton was opposed to what he called the little arts of popularity. So he wanted to find a manner of presidential selection and prescribe a kind of conduct for the president that, as I said, was restrained. But he also believed the Constitution in Article II gave the president adequate powers to defend the nation from foreign attack and also from any sort of domestic insurrection. So I would argue that the constitutional presidency that Hamilton envisioned was the one that is sufficient to keep the American people safe, to preserve American nationhood, but it also is without the sort of demagogic downside that we have today.
Thomas Whalen, how much of this ideal, though, is just sort of built into the persona of George Washington himself? I mean, as Stephen describes, this sort of ability to have power, mm-hmm. but also the wisdom to use restraint, that seems that there's only so many checks that, you know, institutions can put it. At some level, it requires a person who is willing to maybe curb his own ambitions. I mean, was Washington the exemplar of that?
Absolutely. They all had Washington in his mind as the first president, and they kind of built the Constitution in many ways around him. And I think it's also important to point out that the founders, most of them, including Hamilton, didn't think the Constitution would last very long, that there was going to be major changes, or at least maybe another one down the line. I think Hamilton, if he was alive today, would be very surprised that it lasted this long.
The other thing that strikes me, Stephen, reading your book, is that it didn't, in your view, take too long for this vision to kind of go off the rails. I mean, we think about, you said that in your view there we have a demagogue in office right now. He often compares himself to Andrew Jackson. But you start sort of the timeline here way back at president number three, Thomas Jefferson. Why so?
I do, and I need to confess up front that I suffer from Jefferson derangement syndrome. But having laid that out there, I do think Jefferson sort of opened the door in terms of moving the office away from any sort of constitutional constraints and rooting the office more in public opinion and seeing the president as the voice of the majority. And then Andrew Jackson takes that and just runs with it. So that by the time you get to the 1830s and 40s, the American president is no longer a check on the potential tyranny of the majority. He's actually being presented as someone who needs to speak for the majority. And the problem with that is minorities pay the price.
Do you see it the same way, Tom, where Jackson sort of accelerates something that had begun years before he really took it to the next level?
Well, he certainly smashed the whole political caucus system and kind of ended the reign of the aristocrats. But also, I'd go back to John Adams, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which Trump would probably favor very much because that's what you're hearing in his rhetoric. But also, you know, before he left office, he was so upset that the Federalists lost, he loaded up the federal judiciary with, you know, judicial appointments of Federalists. So he tried to subvert the very constitutional system that, frankly, was not that, you know, old at the time. So, and, you know, what recent problems, you can see it going back to the second presidency.
We're talking about the office of the presidency, whether it's become too powerful, with historians Stephen Knott and Thomas Whalen. And listeners, we'd love for you to chime in as well. Again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As I said a moment ago, the current president, Donald Trump, sometimes compares himself to Andrew Jackson. He seems to feel a real kinship there. And he talked a little bit about this a couple of years ago on the 250th anniversary of Jackson's birth in Nashville. Here is President Trump at that time.
It was during the Revolution that Jackson first confronted and defied an arrogant elite. Does that sound familiar to you? I wonder why they keep talking about Trump and Jackson, Jackson and Trump.
So, Stephen Knott, why do they keep talking about Trump and Jackson and Jackson and Trump? I mean, do you see the similarities there, or is it a bit of a stretch?
There are some similarities. There's also some stretching involved. But part of the reason they keep we keep talking about it is because people around President Trump have drawn that connection. And President Trump has Andrew Jackson's portrait in the Oval Office, so you frequently see it when you see shots of the Oval Office. Look, they both viewed themselves as taking on the elites of their day. The differences between Jackson and Trump, though, I mean, Jackson truly was a self-made man. He was a general. We could argue the merits of his generalship. There were certainly some problems with that. But he is a self-made man. Donald Trump is not a self-made man.
And you know, that comment that he was part of the revolution, well, not really. You know, Jackson's presidency was you know, decades after the American Revolution. But, you know, Jackson, he is reflective of the times because now the right to vote is extended to kind of regular everyday people, kind of the blue-collar white, you know, workers of the 19th century. And you notice that certain presidents, you know, when there's a change in, like, when you broaden the franchise, certain presidents reflect the changes. And I think it was inevitable for Jackson to do so. He is representative of the common man. I think it's a stretch to say that Donald Trump is representative of the common man, given his own background.
Well, Tom, what about the comparisons to another Andrew Johnson? I mean, we heard a lot of those in recent months as we were going through impeachment, right? We've had very few presidents actually be impeached, Andrew Johnson being one of them. Is that a better parallel, the other Andrew to Donald Trump?
I think so, especially in personality terms. Very stubborn, and they thought, you know, the presidency, you know, gave them the right to kind of supersede congressional oversight in many cases. Though Johnson himself was always, you know, arguing that he was defending the Constitution. And, of course, you know, it went down to, like, one single vote in the impeachment trial in the Senate.
Stephen, you said something earlier about the risks of populism when you have these presidents who sort of see themselves as speaking for the masses, for a whole group of people. And you've written that there's something sort of ironic about that mentality in the sense that there's something almost inherently arrogant about believing that you are the voice of a whole bunch of people, right? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. And you did see that with Andrew Jackson, and I think you certainly see it with President Trump and some other presidents that we've had. And that's this inability to separate themselves from the office they hold. But if you do consider yourself the voice of the people, the tribune of the people, that's pretty heady stuff. And it's easy to blur that line between your political well-being and the well-being of the office of the president and of the United States of America. Andrew Jackson blurred that line. Andrew Johnson blurred that line. I think Richard Nixon blurred it, and I think Donald Trump blurs it.
You also, though, in your writing, point to some presidents who might surprise readers. Woodrow Wilson, FDR, presidents who were, I would say, generally remembered fondly. And yet you say that sometimes it was those progressive presidents who perhaps most overstretched the bounds of the office as it was originally envisioned and have paved the road to Donald Trump. How so?
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson's an interesting case because Wilson spoke openly of the president and the person holding that office being as big a man as he can be. And he said the limits of the office are just the limits that the man himself brings to it. That's, in my view, a dangerous way of thinking. Now, Wilson, you know, is followed by Franklin Roosevelt, who uses this technology that we're using today to develop a bond with the American public, which, you know, helped get us out of the Depression, no question about it. But the problem is the more you personalize the presidency and the more you remove it from its constitutional constraints, it seems to me that the potential for danger is there. And I would argue we're seeing some of those dangers today.
So once again, the number, if you'd like to join our conversation about the presidency, is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tell us, do you think the presidency has become too powerful? Or do you need a strong leader to get anything done in Washington these days? Tom, I'm curious how you come down on populism, because we also see a different brand of it in the 2020 race, and actually 4 years ago as well, in Bernie Sanders on the liberal side of a populist movement. And again, I think you would see a lot of working class people who see him as their champion. I wonder if you see any of the same risks that Steve writes about in that kind of populist figure were he to take the White House.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, they're two sides of the same coin, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, they're basically running on the campaign slogan of FDR in the 1930s, you know, therefore the forgotten man in American politics, you know, that blue collar type who globalization has passed by. And basically the only difference is, well, their prescription, you know, Bernie wants, expansive social, you know, welfare state. You know, Trump basically says we have to just cut taxes, limit government to a certain extent, and, you know, prosperity will follow. But, you know, what they're arguing, they have the same goal, but they're just going about it in slightly different means.
You know, one of the other things I want to think about, too, is what might be able to correct the course. So you write a little bit about this, Steve, in your book. I mean, in fact, it's in the title, right? The Prospects for Renewal. So what are those prospects for renewal? And as we talk about this, I'm particularly mindful of the recent news just last week when the Senate passed a version of a War Powers Act that would curb the president's war-making power in Iran in particular. Now, they didn't get a veto-proof majority, so it may not go anywhere. But there does seem to be some bipartisan agreement that perhaps the power of the presidency has maybe become a little bit too great, at least in the war-making department. I mean, is that the type of thing you see on the horizon?
I used to be a critic of sort of congressional attempts to rein in presidential war power. I'm rethinking that as we speak. But let me say, I think there's a couple things we can do, one of which, in my view, would be to restore the role of party leaders in terms of presidential selection. 2016 is a perfect example of that. Donald Trump showed no indications up until 2016 that he was a Republican. He was not the choice of party leaders. Had party leaders had more of a say, I'm not sure he wins the nomination. I'm not sure he wins the presidency. Same with Sanders in 2016. And to this day, Sanders is not a member of the Democratic Party.
And Bloomberg was a former Republican.
Great. So, look, you know, if we restored some of the old smoke room, you know, the back room where party and look, I know that goes against the grain.
I was just going to say, I mean, we just had James Roosevelt from the Democratic Rules Committee on the phone saying they're trying to go the other direction to be a little bit more transparent. And if I understand right, I mean, part of the idea by having these delegates at a convention or even the Electoral College after a general election is that, you know, if something were to change, if we were to learn something dramatic about a problem with the nominee or the president-elect, you'd have sort of that safeguard to make a change later. I mean, is that the kind of sort of stopgap you're talking
about? That's exactly what I'm talking about. And the other thing, if I could mention, and this is a much longer-term solution, I think we need to really invest in civic education. I'm not sure the American public is aware of a lot of the issues that we're talking about today. They're not aware, I don't think, that there's an alternative way of looking at the presidency that governed this country for 120 years. And so that's going to take a while to get that message out there, but we can do better.
All right, let's bring a call into the conversation. Rob is in Newburyport. Rob, what's on your mind?
Hey, everybody. I'm wondering if there's a breaking point for the Republican Party, right? You know, the Republicans in Nixon's time, there was a breaking point, right? They went to him, they said, you know, we're going to vote against you. And he broke. And is that going to happen to this president ever? You know, let me give you a quick sports analogy, okay? The New England Patriots, they didn't win the Super Bowl this year. But let's just say they didn't lose the playoff game. Let's say they won the game on a penalty. And everybody saw it in the replay. Clearly it was a penalty that was in their favor, but they won the game. Half the audience would say, well, you know what? We've had some bad plays against us this year, and, you know, we're going on to the playoffs. And then in the next game, same thing happens. Last play of the game, there's a horrible, irrefutable penalty, but we win. And then same thing happens in the Super Bowl. At what point does Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, I'm using them obviously symbolically here, at what point do the fans say, you know what? I don't want to win this way. I don't want to be associated with a team that, you know, it's black and white. It's on video. You can see the, you can see the penalty.
Got it. Rob, it's a good point, and I'll put the question to Tom Whalen here. What about that? I mean, is there a breaking point for the Republican Party? I mean, we just had an impeachment, and only one senator, Mitt Romney, voted to convict.
Right. Honestly, I don't see it. And you have to remember, back in the 70s, the Republican Party was much more diverse and represented, you know, it was a true national party. And what's happened in modern times is parties have retrenched themselves into certain areas of the country, regionalization, and certain ideologies, right? So, I mean, the Republican Party now is a small ideological base. It doesn't have moderates anymore. You know, the closest to a moderate is a Mitt Romney, who already is right of center. The same thing with the Democratic Party. And I agree with Steve. If you're going to have change, it's going to have to be like bipartisan basis to kind of rein in this imperial presidency. And that's what it is, an imperial presidency. But unfortunately, I just don't see it on the horizon, that Republicans and Democrats coming together and, you know, especially in the Senate, you know, to protect their institutional and rights and then just kind of challenge the presidency. As we just saw in the impeachment process, that didn't happen. And, you know, I think lately I've been thinking of Octavian Caesar, of all people, you know, and he gutted the old Roman Republic, right? I mean, and, you know, what he did was very clever. He kept the institutions in place, like the Roman Senate, you know, and he claimed that he saved the Republic, but he loaded them with his loyalists and gave them essentially no power. And that killed the Republic in the ancient days. And you got to wonder, I wonder if that's the game plan for Donald Trump, given the moves he's made, that, you know, he's gutted all these institutions. He's gone after the intelligence agencies. Now he's using the judicial system, you know, and the Department of Justice. So, I mean, it's very depressing to see what he's done, this one person has done. But if you look back over the last 50 years, it's not surprising. The presidency has accumulated a lot of powers under Democrats and Republicans, and a lot driving that, and we haven't really talked about that, is foreign policy issues. The Cold War is what created, you know, this imperial presidency. And even after the Cold War, it did not cease, because now we have this thing called 9/11. And, you know, what I worry about now, if we have another event like 9/11 or anything close to it, what this president would do, feeling no restraint, you know, could he, you know, conceivably suspend constitutional order? I wouldn't put that by him.
Let's take one more while we still have time. Bill is in Chelmsford. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. You touched base about something about selecting nominees and going back to a little bit of the backroom politics of it all. You know, something that I think is taken away from a good selection is we allow unenrolled in many states to just choose their party on the day of the election, up to the day of the election. And there's no commitment to any ideals or philosophies or anything. And I think that's kind of, it's too bad, because people who are unenrolled can join Republican that day and then just opt out. And this election doesn't have any real roots to a choice. And I think that's a big problem, because we don't have, you said Bernie's not a member of the Democratic Party. He's not. And we look at Bloomberg, up until a few years ago, he was a Republican. I think that could change the whole dynamics of a two-party system. Maybe we'd have some other parties that might have some strength if we gave we required people to be part of it. We wouldn't let people vote on a company's annual meeting unless they were stockholders. And right now, we don't have any real stockholders in the parties or the selection. That's just my thought.
All right, Bill, thanks for the ring. In the minute that we've got left, Steve, let me just put that question to you. And I guess the counter would be, but, you know, if you do it that way, are you making the process less transparent? You're making people pick sides. They got to choose a party. Doesn't that make us more partisan?
It makes it less transparent. I would still argue that the pluses outweigh the minuses. Look, we've had a lot of mediocre presidents, certainly a lot of the 19th century presidents. Shouldn't end up on Mount Rushmore. On the other hand, they didn't do a lot of damage. And part of the reason was that the party leaders had a tendency to pick those people who were temperamentally suited for the presidency. They're not going to be the greatest people necessarily, but they did not do damage. And as I say in this book, I would take a Benjamin Harrison or a Chester Alan Arthur over Donald Trump any day.
They're not the ones we remember or we put on the money or the mountains, as you say, but those caretaker presidencies, perhaps a bit underrated. Stephen Knott, presidential historian, professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College, and author of The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, The Decline into Demagoguery, and the Prospects for Renewal. Thank you so much for joining us on this President's Day.
Thank you.
Our thanks also to Thomas Whalen, political historian and professor of social science at Boston University. Thanks to you for also joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Atesh Hafti. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.